You know the scene in Fast and Furious where they were in the beginning where they roll up to the deli.
Oh,
the
it was the oil change.
Yeah.
On 22.
We would roll up to Gucci's Grease Monkey.
Yeah, Grease Monkey. Yeah.
That was what we did every day.
Akimoto intake, bro speed header, bro speed exhaust, lowered springs. I think my first pass was probably like maybe 17, 16 seconds. Did 1.6 single cab.
But still, 16 seconds back then, Mustangs were going 15, so it wasn't such a huge gap.
Eat Sleep Race was the slogan that I created as a design for Alpha Racing. Because at that time,
that's all we did.
Eat Sleep Race podcast. We have a very special podcast today. Two guys that help inspire Eat Sleep Race, Dave and Jose. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
So we're going to start that off with why you two inspired Eat Sleep Race. And it was actually more than you two. It was a group and a team. And I'm actually wearing the shirt right now, if you could see it. Team Alpha Racing, founded in New Jersey, started in New Jersey.
Yep.
All was members? Was it actually Alpha? I know we do racing, but was it like our stickers were Alpha? So was it Alpha Racing or was it just Alpha?
First Team Alpha, then just straight Alpha, then also Alpha Racing. So it was just kind of all within the Team Alpha Racing also. But yeah, started in Jersey, Central Jersey.
Primarily imports.
Yeah. Actually, we started off as all imports. Kind of, we had the ideas in 94, me and Yas, and became official around this time, summertime, about 95. When I started driving, actually. So, yeah, that's...
So, kind of crazy. For 95, shows my age here. I was 10 years old back then. So, knowing that you guys were driving already, well before I was even into cars, because I started getting into cars from reading the magazines that my brother was bringing home. How did you get into the import scene when there was no import scene back then?
Well, got into cars mainly because of my brother, my older brother, Ed. Everybody knows Ed. He was into American cars since probably he was 16. And I remember it was maybe around 94, he brought home a Turbo magazine. And it had a Honda Civic in it, Turbo Honda Civic. And we had a Honda Civic back then. And that, you know, gave me an idea, or we both had the idea of, like, we got to hook this car up. Like, look at this car. Like, it's pretty cool. Like, you know, supposed to run, like, 13s or something. Had its original motor, custom turbo kit. So that's how we... That's how it all started, pretty much.
But back then, seeing modified imports, because there weren't even import events back then. So, like, even on the street, it wasn't a thing because there weren't that many modified imports back then. Or were there?
No, not at all. It all started for me as a young kid. My father was into cars. He had a Porsche. So I was exposed at a young age. I used to go to autocrosses, races with my dad. I first got my car in 1993, a 93 Honda Civic Coupe. That's when the import scene was starting out in California. I heard about it through friends who used to go out there for the summer vacations. They talk about doing intakes and exhausts on their cars. So that didn't really pop off till probably 94, 95 out here. There was always rim shops. Then rim shops started selling exhaust intakes. So those are your basic bolt-ons. So my modding cars started about 95.
And what was the first car you modified?
A 93 Honda Civic Coupe.
And what was yours was a...
1990 Civic Si. Hatchback, obviously.
So we all know the import culture started in California and it made its way over, you know, New York, New Jersey. I want to say from as far as I know, you're one of the you guys are the originals in the New York, New Jersey area to start modifying these imports. What was the culture like back then? Like if you made a car, like now if I make a car, I could pick any day of the week and I could go to a car meet. What were you doing with these cars?
Well, at least for us, like, we got everything from the magazines. Like, as soon as we saw something in the magazine, we were just like, wow. And then we'd start seeing ads of, like, shops, like, in, like, Clifton and in New York, Vinny's Hen Shop was probably one of the first ones Ed and I visited. Then Ultima up in New York.
And you went to these places because you saw that they had ads in magazines?
Yeah. That was how we actually knew about stuff. And so also
Performance Factory for Vinny's Hen.
Yeah. And also going to Yauhan, Edgewater.
Now Mitsua.
Yeah.
It used to
be
Yauhan.
We would see all the magazines, like Option. And, you know, we were just like, wow, that's how we got all the ideas. Like, that's how we started seeing the cars. And,
how did you come up with Team Alpha?
Like, before we even get there, when you modified these cars, were there events to take them to? Like, were there meets? Like, what did you do with your cars?
No meets at all. Just hang out at somebody's house and just stared at our intakes.
So 93, I was still in high school. 94, your goal was to have a fly ass car for the prom. So got to get wheels for your car for prom. You know, that was my first mod. I put wheels on my car, make it separated from the others.
But then what do you do with that after? Because there were no meets or nothing to go to.
So in the 90s, cruising the shore was the thing. So you could go 5 miles and take you 3 hours to drive down the strip down the shore. So everybody would just get their cars hooked up.
Seaside Heights.
Yep. So was that like the first place that you guys would start seeing other modified cars that are outside of your circle?
I would say yes for me, because that was a destination to go down on the weekends. It was prom weekend, the weekends after prom. It's just all the hooked up cars. There was always trucks. There was different types of muscle cars, but you wanted your car to stand out. So that was the start for me.
And then how did it transition from there to actually seeing other fast cars or, you know, other fully modified cars?
Street races. Definitely the street races.
So did street racing, what came first? Going to the racetrack or street racing?
Street racing for me. Definitely for me.
Definitely street racing. Because, you know, as the 90s evolved, you got to see coverage, which was 3 months later, because print back then, you'd hear about a race in August. You wouldn't find out about it until January, because that's how slow things got produced. And magazines came out with all the information so many months later that it's not instant like how it is nowadays. If something happening today, you'll see somebody's live and you'll know about it 2 minutes later. Back then, it was months later that you hear about anything or something that was going on.
So how'd you find out about the street races, and where were these street races?
Staten Island, for me, I think was the first. I found out from a friend that I was hanging out with. He was like a rave head, so he was going to Staten Island a lot for raves, and I guess that's how he found out about it. And then he brought me along, and I think with Yas too, and we were just like, whoa, like all these cars, like American cars, import cars, like people were just racing. Like, so we were just like surprised, like this is actually like a thing for imports.
Where in Staten Island was that?
I know it was, pretty sure, I think it was outside of the Outer Bridge. Like, not Fountain Ave, I forgot the name, but it is like right after one of the bridges. Like, I just remember it was like three lanes wide.
And what year was that?
That probably was even like early 94, I think it was. Maybe even end of 93. I know I was still in high school, so it was, crazy seeing that. That's how we met that Terry, one of our team members. Like, he was out there.
Terry Chung?
Yeah, Terry Chung, yeah. It may have actually been 94. I think I had a 94 RX-7 in 94, and he was racing already. He had, like, you know, exhaust bolt-ons and an RX-7, and he was out there, like,
wow,
pretty heavy.
Yeah. Where was the first street race you went?
So my 93 coupe, I just felt, wasn't going to be enough, because all the magazines were like, oh, turbos are this, turbos are faster. So I evolved into a 97 Eclipse GST. That's the next stage for my life that I could afford. So I went turbo. That was 1997 was my Eclipse. We heard about races in Maryland, so we used to go down to MIR for the import races.
So for you, you went to the track before the
street
races.
I went to the track
races
first. Later, 1997, I got exposed to street races. I think I heard about Jose and Ed, Yas, they invited me to hit a town called Danuet, which was the end of the Garden State Parkway.
There was a lot of muscle cars, imports, and that's when I think I was woken up to street racing, because we used to, every Sunday night in the 90s, that was our destination, Nanuet. We knew, meet up at 7 o'clock, take our trip up to Nanuet. We'd be out there till 2, 3 in the morning. They'd be setting up races right on the parkway, be watching from the shoulder, sometimes the factory. There'd be cops chasing us. There's a lot of memorable nights, and we'd be there till really late, early in the morning.
So Nanuet was primarily the spot before even AVP, would you say, or was it happening at the same time?
Oh, this was definitely way before AVP.
There was also Perth Amboy, right?
Yeah, Perth Amboy. I've never been to the ones in Perth Amboy, but yeah, I know that, that was
like, I know Terry, yeah. And then also that's how I met, and I knew that Dave Harry with the Supercharge Integra.
Yeah.
And I remember Yas would go out there and drag race.
Yeah. Perth Amboy I stayed away from, because I didn't want to get followed home and my car gets stolen.
That's how it was back in the day, right?
Yeah, back in the day too, yeah. I think, yeah, that's what kind of made us stop going to street races, because a lot of cars were getting stolen. So we just figured, let's just keep it to the track. At least we can kind of filter out, I guess, so to say, that element, for that risk, you know what I mean? And it was legal too. Like, you know, we didn't want to get pulled over or anything, lose our licenses.
So it's actually funny that you brought up that topic of what was the car after the Civic you said?
97 Eclipse GST.
So recently I met somebody and he was talking about cars in his collection and he mentioned the DSM. I was like, oh, I know what era of cars you're from. He's like, oh, how old are you? So we start talking. He's like, if you're from a DSM era, you're from, I want to say, you know, the foundation of import tuning. Because at the time, the DSMs were the fastest turbo imports. And like you said, like if you just wanted a turbo car, you could get into a Talon, you could get into an Eclipse.
Yeah.
Manual boost controllers, intakes, exhaust, fuel pumps. The car was making 400, 450 horsepower. You know, you're a 12-second car.
And more in the affordable range, because you also had your Supras.
Yeah, 300 ZX, 3000 GT.
I mean... Would you say at that time, you know, there's that generation of, you know, Civics were the entry level because it was the cheaper way to get into modifying the Hondas. Supras were obviously still new at that time, 94 like to 97.
Tier. Yeah, top tier.
So after my Eclipse, my first Supra was purchased 98, 99. That's when I graduated college. You're going to cry when I first... tell you how cheap I bought my Supra.
Were you second owner of the Supra?
I was. There was no such thing as second, third, or fourth owners. It was a used Supra. I was searching on Auto Trader magazines, not online. Used to be...
what did you get at the grocery store?
Grocery stores where it's black and white, like a newspaper ad. I found a 94 Supra. I called the guy. I met him at Home Depot. And I still see the guy. His name's Carlos. He still has his 97 Supra. He's probably one of the craziest builds for a Supra now. But I bought my first Supra for $25,000.
Wow.
So that was 98, 99.
Which Supra was it?
It was a 94 twin turbo white 6-speed Supra.
How many miles were on it when you got it?
I want to say it had 30,000 miles on it. So they were as cheap as $25,000, you know, and no one was buying Supras back then, because there were $50,000, $60,000 cars back then.
The parts were expensive.
Yeah, no one had budgets for a $60,000 car back in the 90s. My 93 Civic I bought for $12,000 brand new.
Right.
Yeah.
So a $60,000 car back then was really expensive. So I bought it for $25,000.
What were the Eclipses and the Talons going for at that time?
A new Eclipse was about $23,000.
Brand new.
So, you know, I said for a couple thousand more, I sold my Eclipse and stepped into a Supra.
For $25,000.
Who would have thought there would be six-figure cars nowadays?
Correct me if I'm wrong on this, but were the first imports into the 9s were DSMs, no?
Well, I don't know.
Well, outside of the rotaries, yeah. I'm pretty sure the rotaries are already going that fast. You know, like the Starlets, et cetera, like, you know, those. But I think, yeah, I think the DSMs were probably the first all-wheel drive in the nines in that era. Yeah, that generation.
That Supra that you had, today's market value on that would be how much, you think?
It's a six-figure car nowadays.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And you got it at 25 grand.
25,000.
So, Jose, let's go to the track, right? I'm sure back then going to the track, a lot of domestic cars showing, you know, I remember seeing you guys at Testing Tunes on Wednesday. All we would see is Grand Nationals.
Yeah. Camaros.
You know, Camaros.
Fox body Mustangs.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Civic.
Yeah.
How fast were you going? Like, how fast were you running? And, like, what were you trying to achieve back then? Like, how fast did you try to go?
First of all, it was just learning, you know, just getting into it, learning the tree, not messing up at the launch, just overall, just being comfortable. Back then, it was single cam motor, original motor, bolt-ons, Akimoto intake, Bro Speed header, Bro Speed exhaust, lowered springs. I think my first pass was probably like maybe 17, 16 seconds. 1.6 single cam. Definitely, I didn't care. Like, you know, it was like cool. You know, people kind of looked at me funny, but I was like, whatever. You know what I mean? This is my thing. You know, it's like, yeah, cool. You got a V8. Mine's just like a single, you know.
But still, cylinder. 16 seconds back then, yeah. Mustangs were going 15, so
It
wasn't such a huge gap.
Yeah,
like
nowadays,
you'll see cars factory run 10s. So 17 second car back then was, wow, you're doing something. You know, we'd just be breaking 90 miles an hour was a goal back then.
Yeah, I mean, my goal was really first learning and then slowly, like, back to the magazines, seeing, like, coverage of, like, Battle of the Imports and all that. Guys going like 13s, 12s. Yeah, maybe 12s was like the fastest in terms of like turbos, but like all motor was like 14, 13s on a single cam. So it was just like slowly, of course, trying to balance going to college too. So I was like, you know what? That's my goal next. It's like, I want to go 14s. I want to be like cool, like, you know, these Cali guys, you know, like I want to be a little bit faster, you know, on a budget, of course, too. So.
And we're talking English Town Raceway Park, right?
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
At that, during those years when you guys were going, were there even official events yet?
No, not yet.
No.
Not yet.
My first official event was in 97 because I know I had my Eclipse. So that's when there was an import event at Maryland International Raceway. So
was it Nopi?
No, Nopi wasn't around until late 90s.
It's like the DSM guys, like, was it like, what's his name? Busher Racing?
And Busher Racing was out there. So Performance Factory, they'd be racing. They were the first. This is when I got my Supra. They were the first in the nines, eights, and sevens. That was their logo on their ad in the magazines. Was the first in the tens, nines, eights, and sevens. So that was Vinny 10.
Yeah, Vinny 10. Yeah.
So at that time, now we're going back to the golden era of import racing, especially in the New York, New Jersey area. Big names back then would be Vinny 10, DRT Ralphie, Craig Paisley.
Yeah, Paisley, yeah.
With the Porsche.
Eddie Bello.
I don't know. Are we going to claim Rado as an East Coast? He was Pennsylvania, but he always seemed like a West Coast guy.
Chris Rado. Rado came later on, yeah.
Yeah, I think that was later. But, like, let's talk about, like,
Gary Gardella.
Not yet, though.
They're still Ultima guys.
Jeff Hill was a DSM guy.
Sam Yao.
Yes, have you? Yes.
Mark Palines.
So those guys were the first, like, JDM-styled cars
that were... I think of it, that's, like, where it first started, is, like, all those guys and street racing, and I met, you know, back then it was very territorial with the crews, right? But, like, I felt like those guys were cool. Like, we hung out with them all the time.
Versus
hanging out with them, like, oh, let's race. hang out.
A lot of those stories also fall back to our trips to Maple Grove. You know, our crew, Alpha, would be cruising down 95, and we'd come across all these other import cars with New York plates, and that was Ultima.
We'd CCMS.
Do a lot of pulls on the highway. So getting to the events were an event in itself. We'd block cars in, slow traffic down, do pulls.
Yeah.
You know, I actually wish we had Paul on this podcast because you were, I think you were there. We had our first Jersey City. What was that bowling alley?
Oh, wow.
Palladium?
Palladium or Playdrome, I think.
Playdrome.
Yeah.
Wow. We were at the Playdrome. Paul just got his swap put in it with Ed. Ed helped out. Arvin.
Yeah.
They did a swap. And there was another crew. I forgot the name of the crew. They had a 240 SX. And we were like, let's race. Yeah. And Paul just got heavy, like smoked them. And we're like, Paul, you're supposed to
take it easy.
Oh, I'm so excited. You know, I got my swap.
Yeah. Wow. Right? I just remember that.
That was your brother, Arvin, from Black Sun.
Yeah, Black Sun. Yeah.
How did Arvin... Paul knew to go to Arvin for the swaps. Like, how did you meet Arvin, and how did you know how that all came about?
Yeah, I know it was through my brother Ed. I think when he was working for a performance shop on 18 in East Brunswick, and I think that's how he met Arvin, and or Jonas, who was also a part of Arvin's crew. So Ed started going down to Arvin's shop. And then I would tag along too, of course. And then Arvin already was doing swaps. This was probably in 96, 97.
Yeah, the Midas, Neptune.
Yeah, Neptune Midas. He had like a 94, 95 SI hatchback. And
so they were doing, you want to say those were one of the original guys to do B series swaps in New Jersey?
Yeah, along with my brother too, yeah. So, I think I met Paul through Dave, and then. That's when I think Paul wanted to do a swap, and pretty sure we did it. My brother did it with Arvin in Midas, Neptune Midas.
Yep.
You know, we skipped very quick here.
Yeah.
Let's go back to what Alpha Racing is. Who is it? Because for a lot of people, the majority of the people watching this, they have zero idea what Alpha Racing is.
All right. So I met Yas in high school. We were in high school together. We would just cut class together even before he had a license. Somehow he was able to drive legally.
Honestly, I don't think he ever had a license. It was always suspended.
So then when we were just checking out like option magazines and all that stuff, we were at the same time just hanging out, playing video games, in Somerset Diner, and it was Street Fighter Alpha. And, as we were just like slowly getting into the car scene, seeing all the magazines, seeing like all the racing teams in Cali, we just kind of thought of like, hey, we should probably do something like this. Like,
let's start a team.
Yeah, let's start a crew. And we were just trying to think of names and just thought about it like, oh, Alpha. Why not Alpha Racing? Because from the Street Fighter. So actually, that's our original logo was just a straight bite off of the Street Fighter Alpha logo. We eventually flipped it. But
so it started off with just you two?
Yeah. Just me and Yas, yeah. Oh, of course, the influence of my brother too, but it was just us as in terms of, and the way we would do it is because from the magazines there was always this phrase like stoplight confrontations, like they're saying like, oh, you know, you do these mods, like get ready for your stoplight confrontations. So Yas and I were just like, yo, like we got to do this, like we got to find some stoplight confrontations.
What is that?
Like, so basically we would, when you pull up next to someone at a stoplight, like, you know, modify a car, just look at each other, like rev your motors and just like go at it, like till whenever, you know, stoplight to stoplight, or just like as soon as someone exits or whatever. So what we used to do was we used to hang out in Edison on Route 1 at like some of the gas stations and just like wait for cars to pass by. And the thing, the thing that would catch our attention was fog lights. Because back then,
Pia fog lights.
That was like the thing. It was like, oh, I think that got Pia's. Then we would just like pull out of the gas station, just start chasing whoever it was, like weave in and out just to catch out to whoever it is. Then just start a race. And I think maybe that's how maybe a bit of our reputation started, because we would do that every like 2-3 nights a week, just trying to find people to race. Like, just for fun.
So people would modify the cars in the area like, yo, there's these cars with these Alpha stickers on Route 1 just chasing you
around.
Probably
was, yeah. And also, too, 287, see another car. Like, I'd probably instigate too. Or like usually I would instigate. I just kind of look over.
So when did it grow beyond just you two?
Just like slowly, like we had a couple other friends back then. They would buy cars and then they would slowly modify, and it was just like, you know, by association, you know, friendships. Likewise, how, you know, we all became friends.
So we probably didn't get on probably till 98, 99.
You met Jose.
Yeah. Like we would be at the track and I don't even know.
Well, I remember you saw me in Middlesex, in college.
Yes.
And I think one time I was waiting for parking and you were stop driving conference, by.
Parking lot confrontation.
And Dave would just look over. I'm just we both look over at each other. And it's just,
I had my Honda Sport sticker on my car. You had your Pia headlights.
Yeah.
Racing stripes.
Yeah, racing stripes. Yeah. So we never got to race each other, though.
No, never.
No.
Those were the staples of that era, right? Racing stripes, Pia fog lights.
Fog lights.
What else?
Intake and exhaust.
Intake, exhaust. Of course.
Iceman, Akimoto.
Yeah, Akimoto. AM eventually.
Underglow wasn't a thing back then, right?
It caught on after Fast and Furious.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, kind of. The truck guys had the underglow stuff.
And rims.
Kind of cascaded.
Yes. Yeah.
Rims were a big thing.
Yeah.
Because not even slamming the cars weren't a thing yet. It's you just have to put rims on your car.
Yeah.
Well, so late 90s was the golden era of hip hop. So. Yeah. Back then, it's like all the rappers would have the Benzes, the BMWs, all on chrome rims. So you knew the drug dealers in the area because they had that same type of car.
Yeah.
So that was the scene back then. Like, you wanted to have what those guys had.
And then the racer era started with just obnoxiously loud exhausts.
Yeah.
18-second cars with crazy, huge mufflers.
Don't forget the big shift light on your dash that lit up the whole car.
Big chrome rims. What else? Clear taillights back then was
well. All the era after Fast and Furious.
That sounds like so the 2000 era style of cars, which I want to say no one within the team even stepped into that fad of clear taillights, underglow.
Ocon had a baby blue EG.
Arabuni body kit. Street Fighter. He had the Street Fighter.
Arabuni. Yeah, wow.
So, yeah.
That's
we did have one or two cars that were...
That never had an Alpha sticker on it.
Not that I remember.
He was part of Prime Association.
Yeah, but
he was with his own... He was with the other guy. I forgot their name.
Ed.
With Ed.
Oh, yeah.
So they're the outside circle of Alpha. They started to hang out.
Because remember, also from that era, that's when it started Wings West, Arabuni, the Shogun kits.
Yeah, Shoguns, yeah.
Anything in the middle of the Super Street magazine, the Nopi ad.
Painted interiors.
Yeah.
The Nopi ads. You had all the body kits.
Double, if not triple exhaust.
Yeah.
Dual muffler on a 19-second Civic.
Fog lights. Everybody wanted fog lights.
Yeah. Well, back then it was, people wanted to go fast, but also it was the look first.
Right.
So
it was going fast, looking good. It was part of the culture, right? It was like a cultural thing. It wasn't just about racing. It was about the lifestyle.
Yeah.
That went along with it. Right. Yeah. So I think we were talking about, it's like music. Music was an important thing of
the 90s.
Yeah.
Right. And we had
a bunch
of friends. So
you're putting boxes in your cars.
Right.
Yeah.
DJ, again, mixtapes.
Yeah, mixtapes, yep.
DJ,
tapes, not CDs yet.
Our friends who are DJs, right? So it was back then, and I still feel like it probably could be that now, but back then it was really about the lifestyle of, the hip-hop lifestyle.
The cultures, countercultures, car culture, just all mixing in.
So that's how that became, I guess, the core of Alpha, because before it was even Alpha Racing, it was just Alpha, which was a group of guys interested in modifying their cars.
Yeah.
And then it grew to Alpha Racing as you guys evolved into making your cars faster and started going to more events, races together as a group, right?
Yeah. Of course, because, we wanted to look good at the pit. We have a big parking space area. Eventually, we'd have our own DJ. We would have tents up. We would be cooking.
You started formalizing making teams. And I think, you know, especially that was the foundation of creating teams for import racing because CLM was back. What were the other teams back then at the track?
Yes, you said CLM, CCMS.
Ultima.
Ultima.
Flip Speed.
Yeah, Flip Speed, yeah. Who were the guys in Nanuet, like the import guys?
Profile.
Profile, yeah, Profile Racing.
Ultima. Yeah. They had a crew.
Yeah.
And then is that also separated outside of the shops, having their own pit area like DRT and Vinny 10?
Well, yeah, those guys were official.
They'd show up in trailers.
So that was a level
still,
above.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess you could say we wanted to look like the shop, a shop or sponsored.
Got
but
it.
But we weren't, but we were just representing as a crew.
Yeah, we were true. This is true grassroots.
Yeah.
It was just a bunch of guys that love cars and the culture, right?
Yeah,
that,
yeah.
That was how it was pretty much put together.
I just wanted it to, you know, look good.
Right.
And the thing was, you know, we all had different cars back then, so showing up to the track by yourself, you're trying to go fast. You're going to gut your car out at the track. You're going to take out your seats, take out your spare tire, take everything that you could take that's bolted down, leave it on the side. And back then, people would steal anything.
Yeah.
So showing up with your crew, your stuff was protected. So we'd probably have 15, 20 cars. Everybody would watch everybody's stuff. Everybody would race at different times of the day. Because we were all in different classes. We had all motor cars, we had turbo cars, we had all-wheel drive cars. So having our pit was like our safe zone at the track.
Yeah.
And then it turned into more of a chill area too, because like you said, then Elite Camp would come and DJ. People would bring grills, cook.
Yeah.
Turned into, I want to say, the foundation and the reason why the Eat Sleep Race mantra started. So for those who don't know, Eat Sleep Race was the slogan that I created. I created it as a design for Alpha Racing.
Yeah.
Because at that time,
that's all we did.
Yeah,
that
exactly,
was
yeah.
The life.
I still have a couple of shirts, like the original print.
Because
of that.
The original shirts I made were for Alpha Racing. It had this logo on the front. And on the back, it had the three box logo that I made, which stood for Eat Sleep Race because.
And with the Civic with the parachute.
Correct.
For the race, yeah.
Because that was my favorite car at the time.
Yeah.
And that's literally what I grew into because of my brother. Like, I was a kid dreaming every day, like, I can't wait to go be around cars and hang out at the track because he would tag me along with him and I would be exposed to the life that you guys were living. I was like, I love this. Like, I love being around the cars. I love the community that you guys built. It's a bunch of guys. Everybody loved modifying their cars. And like you said, like, when you guys would set up at the track, 15, 20 cars, and everybody would watch over each other's stuff, like, created, like, a family, a car family of your own.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny because everything that Fast and Furious, you know, portrayed, if not,
we lived it.
You lived it.
We could have been part two of Fast and Furious.
It's actually the real lifestyle of Fast and Furious came from
our story,
the story of everyone within this generation. Like all those teams that you mentioned were the inspiration of the Fast and Furious lifestyle, right?
Yeah,
term family literally was endeared in Alpha Racing.
Yeah,
because you guys would see each other pretty much all week because you're wrenching on your cars during the weekdays and racing on the weekends. And that's literally where the slogan that's how I came up with it. Like, dude, all these guys do is eat, sleep, and race. They're just with their cars all the time. Because when I came up with that slogan, I was 14. I didn't have a car yet, right?
Yeah.
I created a slogan for a lifestyle that I looked up to and aspired to want to be a part of.
Well, you were a part of it.
By permission, because I'll mention
this. He was born into it.
Yeah, born into it. Yeah.
Correct. Because at that time, Alpha was a very exclusive team.
Yeah.
Many people wanted to be part of it, and that's kind of the reason why selling merch became an opportunity.
Yeah.
Because I convinced you, and this is how I made the first shirts ever for Eat Sleep Race.
Yeah.
Could I make shirts for the team?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you were getting, you were doing, I think
you guys rolled to the track.
Part of the first web, our first website.
I made the first website,
yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, 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 yeah.
With permission.
Yeah.
You guys would roll to the track, but not everyone would have an Alpha shirt. I think Jose and Yas and probably a couple people had them.
Yeah, yeah, because back then it was hard.
Not everybody even had banners back then.
Because no one knew how to make them, right?
Yeah, we had a place to go, but yeah, back then it was kind of expensive because you know you wanted to save up for mods. I think back
knowing
then
how to make banners and shirts and stuff, it's not like it was today. And that's how I learned how to make shirts. I looked in the Yellow Pages, and I think I found shirts by looking up a baseball uniform in the Yellow Pages. And I called, like, hey, do you guys print T-shirts? And, like, what's it for? Is it for a team? Like, yeah, it's for a team.
Yeah.
Right? So, and then that's how we printed the first shirts. I remember at Piscataway High School parking lot, which is where you guys used to hang out a lot.
There. Yeah, those are every meetings.
Yeah, that's where you would have your meetings. After.
Actually, even before that, before Piscataway, and I just, you know, when you brought up, like, the whole family from Fast and Furious, I just picture us, you know, the scene in Fast and Furious where they were in the beginning where they roll up to the deli.
It was the oil change place.
Yeah.
On 22.
Yeah,
we would roll up to Gucci's Grease Monkey.
Yeah, Grease Monkey, yeah.
On Route 1.
Yeah,
and we would roll up.
Yeah, that, we would have our meetings before
the events.
Yeah.
Gucci would be changing, doing oil changes for us, and we're just hanging out there. That was what we did every day,
that's
right?
True,
if we weren't there, we would be racing,
yeah,
or we'd be going to a car show, Hot and Poor Nights, or some sort of car show,
or somebody's garage, or someone, watching them work on their car.
Yep.
We did a lot of we lived that lifestyle growing up.
Yeah.
So knowing that the T-shirts at the time. There was a point where we went to the track, everybody had an Alpha shirt on, and other people at the track would ask, like, how do I buy those shirts? Because it had the Eat Sleep Race logo on the back.
Yeah.
And it was like, no, you can't buy the shirt. It's for the team only.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like one of those, like, you can't have this logo unless you're part of the team. But then Jose was very strict on who he let into the team because, like I mentioned, it was a family. You're like, you're just not going to let Joe Schmo off.
I remember asking Paul, because Paul was Alpha, right? So I was like, Paul, I want to be part of Alpha. I'm gonna talk to Jose. I'll see what. He's like, he asked me what exhaust you got. I was like, oh shit.
I don't know. Not the Camry.
No, this is a Civic. I had the Civic Si, 99 Civic Si. I was like, Paul, I want to be part of Alpha. He's like, Jose, ask what exhaust you got. I was like, damn it, I don't got a nice exhaust right now. So I was like, you know, I had to, you know, Jose he cared about who was part of the crew. He cared and he wanted to make sure that if you were going to be part of the crew, that you would represent being fast, you know, being as fast as you can, having good style. Like, he looked into all of that, you know, so it wasn't just like, oh, okay, you got a Civic Si, all right, you're part of the crew. It's like, no, he was like, what wheels is he thinking about rocking?
You had to check Jose's, you know, boxes.
Right.
You got to be a cool person.
Yeah.
You got to get along with everybody on the team.
And
your car can't be raced out.
A couple times at least. Run.
Right. You have to race. You have to have.
Take care of the pit first, too.
Yep.
So
we had our pit crew, our pit bosses.
Yeah, pit bosses. Yeah, pit boss.
Rudy.
Shout out to Rudy.
He's still the pit boss.
Chip.
Glenn. Yeah, Chip, of course. Lee Camp, of course.
So if Fran went down the route of following the fad of chrome wheels, underglow, crazy vinyl on the car, he probably wouldn't have been part of Alpha.
Yeah, probably not. Probably not. Yeah.
Well, back then, we were always pushing each other to go fast. We'd be talking junk to each other.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. Like, if you needed something,
somebody needed something, we're over to your house, we're fixing the car. Paul's house became the frat house.
But everything was done tastefully. TE37s were the standard for the team. That's where I got introduced to TE37s because I saw Paul had them. Dave had them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I remember Ralphie at DRT had 17s on his twin turbo.
No, they were 18s.
Oh, 18s. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Like, all the fast guys, and the guys to my taste, had T37s back then. So I was like, when I get my car, I'm getting T37s. And now, today, like, it's
so many versions of T37s.
Correct. Yeah. Now all his cars have. Everyone, everyone else, pretty much. Yeah, pretty much everyone has TEs.
That's one of those things, Nick, where Nick said off camera, he's like, now all six of your cars have T37s. It's one of those things. Like, man, I like Jordan 1s, seeing Michael Jordan playing Jordan 1s. So when I get money, I'm buying Jordan 1s. And now I have hundreds of Jordan 1s, right? Yeah. So it's the same thing. Like, these guys who I look up to have T37s. When I get money, I'm buying T37s. Now everything's got to have T37s, right?
T-37, well, back then, everything. You know, Jose mentioned it. He would go to, you know, Mitsuha, which was Yahan before. He would look at options magazines. I think back then, and still now, right, we were trying to
learning the culture.
We were trying to recreate that JDM vibe.
Yeah, without it being JDM at the time.
Right.
Yeah.
For example, I remember one of our guys when at Cedar Oaks, Danny with the CRX.
Yes.
He tried to get the Top Fuel body kit.
And he had it. He did a well representation of that car.
Right. Like, so everyone wanted that it still is big now, but back then everyone wanted to be JDM.
Yeah.
Not everyone.
Well, for us. Almost. Our crew.
This crew.
Slowly.
Was inspired.
Clean.
Right. Yeah. Correct.
Right. We wanted that clean JDM look.
And I think that's where my inspiration of cars came from, because I looked up to you guys and I saw the flip side of it, you know, the gaudy side, the Lambo doors. And not to say that was a humongous culture of its own. And those people watching or who come across this podcast were like, that was me. I get it. That was what you guys were into, but this crew was not
into it. We wanted to go fast. That's the thing. So back 98, 99, my girlfriend back then, Jess, I charged her Honda Civic. So I found...
Like on a credit card?
Credit card.
Yeah.
But her Civic was a 92 VX.
Dave introduced me to credit. So I bought my turbo kit off of credit.
Live a 92 VX. Like, I wanted her to get into the scene because, you know, she was dating a car guy. And I wanted her to have something of her own. She didn't have a car, so I charged her car for her.
How much did you charge?
It was $3,200 for a 92 Civic back then.
How'd you charge? Oh, one from a used car dealership.
Used car dealer in Linden on St. George Ave. Found the 92 VX, which was the lightest car because I knew we were going to turn it into a race car. That swap maybe she drove it stock for maybe 6 months. Back then, it was all about karma, so I had to find a motor that had papers. There was a lot of stolen motors back then, but I knew I was giving it to my girl, so I had to go the legit route.
What was the legit route?
Go to junkyards.
Junkyard.
I used to go to junkyards, try to source engines from crash cars. So you used to be able to find LS motors, GSR motors.
How much were they going for back then?
Back then, they were about $2,500 to $3,200, depending on what dealer and what it came with. Some would take the distributors off and sell it as a
separate
part. Take trannies off, sell that as a separate part. So we wanted something original, so we found a 95 GSR from a crash car. I bought that from a dealer or salvage yard in Linden. Comes on a crate, picked it up. My friend installed it. And she had her first swap, 99. GSR swirlies were GSR, you know,
swirlies.
The wheels to use back then. So her car just looked like a stock car, lowered exhaust.
Sleeper look.
Sleeper
look.
Who
did the swap on her
car? So that was a friend from high school. He used to just...
Mike
Maresca. Yeah.
Maresca.
So he did her swap in a home garage.
That guy's meticulous too.
Yeah.
Work without shoes.
Yes. So that car, we raced.
Swaps without shoes sounds crazy.
We raced that car for many years. She went as fast as 13.6 with just an intake and exhaust. So back then, that was fast. That car, eventually, we built into a sport front-wheel drive class or a hot rod class car. Back then, that was just... full cage, 10-point car, turbo, big slicks, so 26-inch slicks back then. So that was 98, 99. I was charging everything. I was just finished college, bought my first place, trying to go fast, racked up debt, trying to be the first in everything. I bought a one-piece front end because those Cali guys had it. I don't think anybody on the East Coast had it yet. Gardella was still building his car.
He was Echo sponsored back then. I was a private guy just charging everything to try to go fast. That car got built in Long Island.
Axis Tuning, right?
Axis Tuning, Nino. JD was our engine builder. We were on DFI back then. So the car went as fast as 10.6 in early 2001. But cars just evolved so fast in those early 2000s. That's when corporate came in, GM came in, and man, we jumped from 10s to the 8s to the 7s in 2-3 years.
And you guys dropped out.
Just couldn't keep up with corporate funding. Yeah,
so at one point, Jess was racing Gardella?
She never got to line up with him, but we were building at the same time. Gardella was starting to make a name for himself. Like I said, credit card debt just kept on racking up. I was still racing my Supra. There was events every month at Englishtown. I was buying and flipping cars to try to keep up with the expenses.
On credit too, right?
On credit.
Yeah.
I was always buying and selling cars back in the early 90s, 2000s to try to keep up. I remember I bought a salvaged flooded Integra for $12,000 from a junkyard. It had less than 100 miles on it, but it got flooded. So I charged that car as well. My wife was using that car, and it got stolen at Englishtown. And I said, I'm still racing. The car's gone. There's nothing we could do about it. Finished racing that day. That was a blessing. Insurance paid out full value of that car. So I got paid $24,000 for a car that I charged $12,000 on. So I've been blessed throughout the years, buying the right cars at the right time. so getting cars stolen really worked out in my favor. It happened a lot in the 90s. People's cars would get stolen. In the 2000s, people's cars were still getting stolen.
Jose, did you ever get a car stolen from me?
Knock on wood, nope.
Thank God. I think everyone here.
Thank God.
Car stolen, car stolen, car stolen. We all got our cars stolen back in the day.
So that was a big thing. So that's why my Supra, I could take that car everywhere. I drove that car all the time. I raced it for 5 years, and I bought it for 25, and I sold it for more than I bought it. So again, another blessing. I was able to sell that car for $30,000 to one of your high school friends. That car ended up getting done full veil side kit, I think it was. Painted blue. Nah, he crashed that car. It was a high school kid. So I sold that car. Most of my cars I've always sold for a profit. I've been lucky to buy them at the right time, so they become more valuable as time goes on. So that money, I attempted to purchase a R34 back in 2002, 2003. They were highly illegal then, but I rolled the dice.
What was that name of that company? Motor-X.
Bringing them in, but, you know, I didn't go the legit route. I tried to get a gray market car. I put up a lot of money and lost that money. So I rolled the dice through a lot of things in life. And some have paid off, some haven't. That one was a big loss.
Going back to mentioning getting cars stolen, the three of us unfortunately experienced it. Back then, having that alpha on your windshield was kind of a
target. It was a target.
It was a target, but it was also a...
we had some respect.
It was
a
theft deterrent, right?
Yeah,
Because of the respect that the team has built from going to the street races and at the track. It was a small community that also involved the dark element of the side of the tuner culture as well.
Yeah.
It was theft.
Yeah, there was
the people stealing the cars were at the same events and races that you guys were racing at.
Most likely, but in a sense that I guess we had enough people, friends of friends, or maybe some team
acquaintances.
Members.
Yeah, correct. The acquaintances. That respected the cars and the group of, no, those guys in Alpha, they got fast cars, they got nice cars, leave them alone.
Or they was, if they would get it, someone would
try to help out.
Yeah, help out, or we
Like Kali Supra, that car got stolen. And through our acquaintances, we were able to buy that car back.
Right.
From the person that stole it.
Yeah.
As ransom.
The buyback, ransom.
So let's just say there were crews of people stealing cars. There was a good amount of them who had enough respect for Alpha to not touch the cars.
Yeah.
But let's say a new crew came in, stole the car not knowing it was Alpha. Somebody within the group would make a call to that network and say, who took the car?
Yeah.
And that happened to Kali. So they were able to buy that car back.
Yeah.
And I do remember when my car got stolen. For one, it was the first thing, like, who would steal an Alpha car?
Yeah.
But
there was a lot of new generation crooks.
It was a new generation of people who stole my car. So I made those calls. Me and my brother made those calls to whoever we knew, like, yo, find out who took his car.
Yeah.
We want to buy it back. But at that time, whoever took the car was so new to stealing cars that we didn't even have access to an option to buy the car back, which kind of sucked.
When my car got stolen, I found the car before the cops did. I called one of our guys and say, hey, he's like, if it's stolen, we got to go over here. So we went to Newark. We drove around. And he's like, yeah, this is usually the area where they dump the cars. And I was, you know, I was in the back seat. And I was like, oh, man, they got that car. I'm like, whoa, that's my car.
No way.
Yeah, so it was my car on the street of Newark. And they stripped it. They stripped it down.
Talking about that side of the culture of, you know, a lot of theft back then. This was when you guys started with your Civics, B-Series was a brand new Frankenstein. Like, people weren't doing it back then. There was no YouTube to learn how to do it. Magazines couldn't even teach you how to do it because you guys were literally the first figuring out how to do it, developing. Basically, everyone who...
I think it was IRC and the forums where my brother picked up
stuff. That was probably even before Honda Tech?
We had way before, I think right before Honda Tech. I think where he found out about wiring was either IRC or somewhere. Like some of the forums.
There was some type of forum that had plugs and pins and what to wire the VTEC solenoid.
Yeah.
And that's where the community of Honda Tech actually grew, because it's a whole bunch of people. Internet's kind of new back then.
Yeah,
a whole bunch of people who were getting into swapping cars. Like, how do I figure this out? And everyone started discovering Honda Tech. So that's how that Honda Tech community grew. Because it's all people from around the U.S., if not around the world, learning how to swap Civics, put B Series into Civics, and if not out of the platform, CRXs, Del Sols, etc.
Yeah,
that's how the Honda Tech community.
It was a crowdsource.
Correct.
Yeah.
And then the Honda Tech meet in Englishtown. Do you guys remember that? I think that was even before Honda Day.
Oh
that
yeah, was yeah.
Way before.
Yeah, before Honda Day, it was like a Honda Tech meet. Yeah.
So going back even before Honda Tech, I want to shout out to the guys at Urban Racer.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So those Urban guys Racer. Embraced our team. Yeah. They'd always save us spots like in the forefront of the track. Urban Racer was a forum event coverage. Like back in the day, you raced, you went on that website to try to find pictures of your car.
Yeah.
So their photographer, their event coverage,
Jackie, Steve, Tom,
and Preston.
Shout out to those guys.
So those guys were
the OG
forum,
media,
social media.
They were basically like
online social media for
right
for import the import.
That was the social media back then.
Yes.
So the forums, really social because you could only look at pictures, but you were considered cool. Like, oh wow, I made it on Urban Racer back then.
So the forums were also an avenue that I used to make money because I was able to sell parts, sell cars. That's what helped fund the race cars, the cars throughout the years, selling cars on Honda Tech. I became known as probably one of the go-to guys to sell or buy a car from.
What was your username on Honda Tech?
Money Making Dave.
Oh, that's right.
So... I'd always buy cars.
Jose's like, oh, I saw your parts listed.
Yeah. But back then, like, you can't go 8 hours without bumping your thread 20 pages later.
Yeah.
So back then, 8 hours later, you got to go back to your thread, bump, try to get to the first page to try to sell your stuff. So I've sold a lot of cars throughout the years, and they're all simple builds, always swapped, stock bodied, wheels, exhaust, intakes.
So even before, well, that's where primarily people were going to get information of how to make their cars faster, because that's the golden era of most of these companies today. Skunk 2, HKS,
Skunk Works before.
Ready.
Yeah, Skunk Works, yeah.
Like, that's where people were exposing their products, and Drag Cartel, right? Like, these were the heydays of developing parts to make Hondas go faster, and then exposing it to the culture through the magazines, through the forums, getting feedback.
Oh, yeah.
And because at that time, those big companies, they wouldn't come to the events on the East Coast where they could interact with people, right? Like, you would just buy them through
dealers. It was after Fast and Furious, I think. Yeah. That's where the traction started to gain. But, like, for back then, right, like, the only way we had access to the culture was through these magazines right here.
Yep, definitely,
right?
Yeah.
Oh, so I'm going to bring these up. I've had these sitting here. We got Super Street, Turbo, Sport Compact Car. What were the magazines, like, when you started in 1994, what were you reading back then?
The Turbo, definitely. Then Sport Compact slowly came out. Then
but Turbo at that time was primarily domestic cars.
Yeah, yeah. Turbo, yeah. Turbo magazines is strictly American cars. And then
Grand Nationals.
Yeah, Grand Nationals.
Isn't it funny, though, because I did notice this. The Turbo logo has Japanese letters in it.
Yeah, yeah.
So kind of back
evolution,
then.
Evolution, yeah, of it.
I guess they made a hard transition at some point. Like, we're going to stop doing domestics and just do imports only.
Yeah. It was
that Miles'
crazy
car on there? Rev Hard?
Yeah, Miles Bautista.
Yeah, it's crazy that how it evolved.
Right. And all these big names that we're aware of, we learned them all through these magazines.
Oh, yeah.
Let's name them all. Ed Bergenholtz, Miles Bautista.
Jojo.
Jojo Callis.
Dr. Charles.
Skunk 2 guys. Yeah, Dr. Charles.
The
yeah.
Kubos.
The Kubos.
Lisa Kubo.
Leslie Durst back then, All Motor.
Chris Rotto, Gary Gardella.
Lukowski.
Stephanie Agum, rest in peace.
Sean Hillier.
Jeremy Lukowski.
Yeah.
That single cam guy, busy.
Busy
Moto, yeah.
Yeah, he's into Porsches now.
But these are all the guys that, you know, we're talking about local legends prior to this, but these are the guys that you're flipping the pages every month that these come out. Like, man, these are the guys to look up to.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Right? Like,
so those were a lot of the West Coast guys. So we had Impo. We had the DSM guys, Hill, Busher.
We had Vinny 10.
Yeah, Vinny 10, Craig Paisley.
Eddie Bello.
Flacco was out there.
And then you're not even talking about the
the
rotary guys yet.
Norris was also back then. He was a Virginia guy.
Pepe Loco. Like, remember being in the stands at English Town? Like, it was one thing watching the Civics go fast, but when the rotaries come out,
forget it.
Yeah. Like,
back then, USA versus Team Puerto Rico.
So those were big events. The lowrider events at English Town were also huge. Funkmaster Flex, when we got invited out to do one of his car shows.
And you got to shout out the OG in the area. Without Javier Ortega, events would not be in the East Coast.
Yep.
Javier Ortega is the OG of bringing import events to the East Coast.
He's actually embraced our crew.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
He's embraced our crew. I worked at English Town Raceway Park.
Yeah, I volunteered. I've done it too. I think
we've all worked our way through the system.
Yeah, we were. We were.
It was
kind of weird because we were Asian, and they're like, "You worked at Raceway Park." That's weird. But yeah, we were part of the import culture back then.
I'm glad you bring that up, right? Because Raceway Park, prior to '94, primarily, it was for domestic drag racing. Then that slow transition.
I just remembered. I think even before I drag raced, I went to a SECA event at English Town, and there were some Hondas there. So that's where I kind of also got the ideas of hooking the Civic up. Also,
But from a drag racing perspective,
non-existent.
Non-existent back then.
And then that's when the culture started. You know, Javier's Colombian, you're Filipino. You guys brought in the import culture to the track. And that's actually the reason, I don't know if many people know about this, how Javier started doing events at Raceway Park. He saw what was going on in the magazines as well on the West Coast. and he would go to the street races in New York, and that's how he met DRT Ralphie. And Javier actually was a partner in DRT Racing. That was a business of Javier and Ralphie. They started DRT Racing. Javier would go to the street races and say, there's a racetrack in New Jersey. How come these cars aren't racing on the track? So Javier went to an event and met the owner, Vinny Knapp, and asked Vinny if Vinny could have an import event. Vinny knew nothing about import racing. He's like, listen, if you could get those cars here, then, you know, we could have an event. So Javier took it upon himself. He went to the New York street race and started inviting everybody.
Survival Series, I think, was the first
couple.
Survival
Series, that's the name,
I would remember, Jose.
Even before Survival Series, because he started Survival Series when he worked there. This was predating that. He didn't even work for the track yet. So he went there and told everybody, let's go to this test and tune at Raceway Park.
Yeah, it was even before events, right? Because, like, back then, when we would... I think back then, all we had were test and tunes on Wednesday. Yeah.
Wednesday and Friday.
Wednesday and Friday. I remember... I didn't know you back. I didn't meet you, but I knew of you because I would hear on the loudspeaker. The guy, I forgot his name, but he knew you. Here we go. We got Jose Cello in this Honda Civic. Like he kind of made it like it was a strange thing back then, which it was because once again, right? All domestic cars on the Jose Cello. Here's Jose Cello, and that's how I was like, oh man, Jose's. You know, that's how I heard of you and how it all like. Kind of
so at this time, was Javier already working there?
No, not yet. Yeah. I don't think so.
No?
Maybe.
I think that's probably when he first started.
Yeah, when we first started.
Because
yeah.
he started, he brought the cars to the test and tune, and that's when Vinny's eyes opened. He's like, I didn't even know these cars were being modified and they raced.
Yeah.
So then I believe the story is Javier told him, like, let me try one event if I can, you know, do it for you. And then that's when he started working at Raceway Park as the
promoter.
Only doing import events?
Yeah, he was only doing import events back then.
And then he...
Import Survival Series.
So Survival Series was our local once a month race.
That was even before Street Wars.
Yes.
Street Wars wasn't
after. That's after NHRA dissolved.
What was the evolution of import events at Raceway Park? Import Survival Series.
Survival Series, then...
Then he started the three big ones.
Spring Nationals.
Summer Fall.
Summer Slam.
And fall then Fall Nationals. And then NHRA came on board. Nopi would come out.
When was the first IDRC. Time the heavy hitters from the West Coast came to Raceway Park?
That was what ATCO.
Yeah, first ATCO and then Englishtown.
Who brought them out? Was that Battle of the Imports or
Battle came out to ATCO?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Battle first.
Yeah, they came in on an open container.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah,
not a container, but a open trailer.
Open trailer.
There was it was like Papadakis, that was like the that was the thing. They're like, oh, we got to go there. We got to see this East Coast, West Coast. Yeah. And then it rained out.
It rained out.
Yeah.
And then IDRC, Nopi. All started to come up and throw their events.
That's Nopi didn't really come up till later, till NHRA got involved.
Yeah.
But it was really IDRC, Battle of the Imports. IDRC was Jim?
No.
Yeah.
Mike Ferrer.
IDRC wasn't Jim Law too? He was part of IDRC.
Was he?
Yeah.
Wasn't Mike Ferrer
He was the editor of Turbo Magazine for a little bit.
But he also did IDRC.
Yeah, Dragsport.
With Jim.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't even know that.
So that Jim was, he got into drag, he was a drag racer first.
Shout out to Jim. Jim is the founder of Formula Drift. Super OG.
Yeah, and now he's, I believe, general manager at PRI?
Correct.
Okay.
So that was one of those, you know, like, shout out to everybody who was... an OG in the industry. You know, even talking about magazines, you had Turbo, Super Street, Sport Compact Car, Import Tuner,
TMR,
TMR,
0-60,
Honda Tuning,
RPM, Cali. I used to work for RPM.
RPM?
Yeah, RPM magazine.
Who are we missing out?
Yeah, there were I think there were like two more other ones that I
Drag
like
magazine came out late. Yeah. There were a bigger magazine.
D-Sport.
Yes.
Yeah, Drag Sport, yeah.
And I'll actually mention, so like talking about OG is like Jim. He actually started off as a party promoter and then he ended up rising through the ranks and now he's, you know, at the top of the industry right now, sitting on you know, general manager of PRI. Another cool one to mention is the founder and editor of Zero to 60 magazine, Brian Scotto, who's originally from the East Coast, ended up becoming the founder and creator of Hoonigan, which is, you know, the biggest motorsports brand. So that was another like eye-opening. OG. Yeah. A lot of people are like, oh, I didn't know that was him.
And, you know, back in the day, because so now you could kind of get close to these guys because of social media, right? So you could, you know, they're posting stories, so you could be part of the, back in the day, the only way that you could get connected to these guys, go to SEMA.
Yeah.
Yeah, true.
And that's all we did. That's all we did in the early 2000s. Every year we went to SEMA, and that's how we met. We met the editors, Super Street. We met all the editors.
That's the only way you could connect with them.
That was the only way back then.
So our first leg in or foot into SEMA is Kali, Fran, Terry, myself. We got roped in to doing a tire survey. So they invited us to say, come out work. You can see SEMA. And literally did we know we had to look at every single car.
That was for Dunlop, right?
Yes. We had to look at every single car and document what brand and what size tire was being used by these show cars. It was work, but
we made it. I mean, we basically had to look at every single square footage of SEMA because we had to look at every single tire.
But we were so naive back then that we were working like slaves for the experience. So we got put up.
Yeah, I paid to fly out. We asked Kali for buddy pass probably to get us out there.
We got free housing, free meals. The parties back then, oh man, we had some good times back in the days. SEMA, we did probably a 10-year run, never missing one. We got to see the height of the show where it peaked and it went downhill after a lot of funding got pulled. The rim and tire section used to be a huge party in itself. All the car sponsors were there. Everybody needed to be there. Anybody who wanted to wake somebody up, they were there. Falcon, Goodyear, Dunlop. Falcon had always, you know, the front space. As soon as you walked into the rim and tire booth, that's when drifting started taking off. So I want to say that was like 2003 when D1 first came to Englishtown. Javier was again once cross promoting drifting and drag racing during one event. And Fran and I, we started our webpage, speedlounge.com, because we were trying to get a community together that wasn't just based on one brand. So Honda Tech, everybody, the GM guys, the Ford guys, Mazda guys, they were all on Honda Tech. So our take on it was, let's have a community that's not one brand related. So we started the Speed Lounge back in 2005.
It was a forum.
We did event coverage. Our one friend who became a photographer for NHRA got hired to do the event coverage for the sport compact industry. So we tagged along. We crashed in his room.
Shout out to Rich.
So as he covered all those events,
We would fly out too.
We covered a lot of the events on throughout North America.
Yeah. That was Rich Levine.
Rich Levine.
So that was his hobby, but his vision of getting burnout shots and action shots were the forefront of photography back then for this industry. So he landed the gig for Sport Compact Car or NHRA, and he covered that. And we traveled with him for many years.
And we bought that's so easy. And this was I had this vision, which it's so easy now these days, but like to do video, to have video coverage, and you know, I was like, Dave, we got to buy the Canon. We got, everyone's got the Canon camera. This is, you know, I forgot how much, Harry, how much were those Canon cameras back then?
We charged this.
no matter what it was, you recharged it.
You've done a lot of charging. Where's all that debt now? Paid it all off?
Zero debt.
Oh, good. Good for you. Man. Good for you.
Zero debt.
But yeah, I was like, Dave, we got to buy the Canon camera. Everyone, you know, this is going to give us quality. We bought the Canon camera. I still have it till this day. It's underneath the bed somewhere. I promise I give it to Harry to clean up and stuff. But like, we were at the forefront of getting the video, trying to get it onto the internet.
YouTube wasn't even out
then.
Yeah,
YouTube was not a thing
back
then.
We were paying for server space. So that's why we lost a lot of footage, because we were paying monthly to upload images, upload videos. And
was Nice Ones doing video back then?
They were starting. But we were, Urban Racer was all about photos. We were like, okay, let's, you know, they got the photos. Let's go in with the video. And the hardest part was that transition of trying to take a analog footage and convert it into digital. It's like,
ASAP too, right?
It was so hard to do.
You guys were ahead of your time.
If YouTube, we'd probably be a lot well off
if there was YouTube, we would have saved a lot of money, because we would have just uploaded everything.
Yeah.
There was Street Fire.
Street Fire was but it was a lot of street racing back then. They were recording a lot of, like, we were trying to come in at that angle of like recording like events.
We were trying to get corporate.
Hot Important Night videos.
We wanted to sell commercials as income for our videos.
It was hard.
Yeah. It was a lot of long days.
I give a lot of respect to our guys that helped put this podcast together. Nick and Harry, like, you have to stare at this footage over and over again. You know,
set it up. Wait, this thing set up.
You know, too. Going back to how you said that you got to SEMA, actually, you paid your way out there just because you wanted to be involved. And, you know, it's like SEMA still is to this day, like, that one event, if you're a car guy, like, that's,
you got to go to,
you got to experience it, right? But it's kind of a enlightening to go back and look at this all in retrospect, like, especially for myself, always looking up to you guys, you know, prior to me having a car, like, man, I want a car just like those guys one day. And then when you have a car, it's like, all right, now that we're together as a team in the pits, man, we want our pits to look like the official guys,
corporate
guys, like Bullish, Gardella, the guys who had the trailers and whatnot. Like, man, we aspire to have that one day. And then how do we get involved? Like, how do we actually get involved in the street? Because we're just nobodies. We're a grassroots team from New Jersey. And then slowly guys in the team start getting involved in the industry. Francis starts working
for Dunlop.
Growth.
Well, growth. Javier or Dunlop first?
Dunlop.
No, Javier first.
Was it?
Yeah.
I think it was Javier, yeah.
So then Fran starts working for Javier, helping host the events that we would go attend. And then Kali and Fran get the opportunity to work for Dunlop. So it's like, now these guys are actually...
It was actually Tactics Racing, and we were helping them market Dunlop tires. So...
You That's drove the rig.
Tactics. Yeah, we drove the rig.
You drove the 18-wheeler for like 2 years, right?
So it was a toter home.
It was a toter home. Renegade. It was a Renegade 18-wheel.
Yes, something that we as a team always aspired. We got to have one of those.
And we technically...
We
technically did. I mean, we brought it everywhere that the crew went. I brought my car. I put the car in the trailer. I put Brian's car in the trailer. That's right. I'm telling you, if there was social media back then, I would have been very popular, like cross-country, just showing... How many times Colin and I went to cross country? Probably like over a dozen times. I'm actually never went to cross country ever again because of that. But like
PTSD.
We brought Brian. I brought Brian along with me. He drove his. I shipped his car out to Cali. Imagine we shipped your car out to Cali for free. Like, that would have been like a $3,000. And Brian was able to drive his car in California.
TJ too, right? Did you bring TJ's car?
Or I think we probably did.
The most memorable and the achievement of building a car, because we looked up to the West Coast so many years
to drive the car,
and then
there.
Now I have my modified car. That car, at the time that we brought it to California, it was at its peak. Like, that's when I was the most proud of that car. And Fran was going to Hot Import Nights with the Dunlop rig, and he's like, yo, Brad, we have an extra space open.
Oh, wow.
Let's put your car in. I was like, dude, I made it.
Yeah,
like,
exactly, yeah.
I'm bringing my car to California. Like, California was the pedestal, right? Like, for car culture, like, dude, my car at its prime, it's going to Hot Import Nights, which is, like, the best event, the best car show back then.
Yeah.
That was, like, the peak of that car. Yeah,
representing, too.
Yeah, no, with the Alpha banner, yeah, you know, it's like, dude, that was an experience.
I think, you know, once looking back at, you know, just everything that's just been said here, like even from how we first started, it's really around making those connections, right? Like if I didn't meet Jose and Dave, we would have never been to where we are today. Like if we
didn't meet Jose and Dave, the Eat Sleep Race logo would have never came about because I would have had no team to make it for.
And we wouldn't have this podcast right now.
True. That's awesome. Right?
Yeah.
So I think what I'm getting at here is, you know, we started out at zero. I started out at not even being interested in modifying cars. I got interested in it, and now, you know, where Eat Sleep Race stands in the industry for being around for 25 plus years, the respect that we've gained and the you know, we've grown beyond import culture. We're, you know, involved in NASCAR and all forms of motorsports to this point. You know, it's eye-opening to, you know, reflect and have this conversation of, and remember how things were 25 years ago?
Oh yeah, man.
And to where the car collections that, you know, Dave has built throughout the years, and to bring Jose back into the culture, because
I've been out of it.
Yeah, so I'd like to,
yeah, what happened?
Just life, man.
From being an OG, you know, one of the first guys to modify imports in New York, New Jersey area, then you dropped out.
It kind of life, because, like, Ed was pretty much the mechanic. Like, I learned how to do some stuff, but he was like the hands-on and the brains in terms of...
Lose interest?
Well, no, because, you know, he was working, you know, professionally as a mechanic, so I guess he kind of got burnt out, kind of felt it. I also, too... kind of got drained. It's like money wise too. So
it wasn't the culture that affected it.
No, not really. I mean, maybe not a little bit, but more of it's like, kind of just didn't have time for it. It was like,
I bring that up because there were so many transitions and so many fads in this culture. I was curious if it was one of those things like, oh, we're just not into it anymore because I don't like, you know, the direction this is going in.
We were in the middle of building an all motor, like full on race car, but I think part of it too was the money, and we just got kind of burnt out. Like, it was like,
yeah, money. I mean,
money's a big thing.
Money's a big thing.
And back then too, like, it was, yeah, parts were available, but when you wanted to build a race car, it was like the fabrication was the cost.
You know, in the houses, I'm sure you could have bought a couple houses with the amount of money that you spent on your cars.
Oh yeah, all of us, yeah,
right?
Of us.
Yeah, sure, like, you just look back, you're like, I could have bought a Rolex watch with one build.
Yeah, the reality of it, though, is, and I see it more present now, once a car guy, always a car guy, because the amount of guys, I've stuck through this, and I'm still fully involved and still love it for the past 20-something years. I've seen guys come in and out, and more so recently, a lot of OGs, including yourself and your brother, coming around to events.
Yeah, I'm reading a lot of, like, other OGs, like, in other...
A lot of guys like, dude, I haven't. Gary Gardella came to Fast Life Fest, and Gary's like, I don't even remember the last time I came to an event. This is awesome, right? Yeah. It's seeing guys come back around, because once a car guy, always a car guy. It's life happens, but when you get the opportunity, like, get that itch again, like, whether it's the money or whether it's time, you know, like, come right back into it. It's still here.
What's your take on it, Jose? It's considering you took, you know, we've been in this for forever. We never got out of it. What's your take of, you know, being in it, getting out of it, and now kind of getting back into it? Like, what have you seen? What's the difference?
Oh, technology. Definitely the technology, the swaps, like the K-Series swaps and all the all-wheel drive and all that stuff. I had no clue about it till probably about beginning of last year. And I was just like, holy cow. Like,
so when you left the scene, B-Series, was it?
Wait, was it again?
When you left the scene,
it was all B-Series and, like, stroked out B-Series. Of course, H-Series, if you wanted it, like, if you had the money. But strictly B-Series, that was my goal, at least. Like, at night, our race car was going to be just B-Series, stroked out. Oh, maybe I shouldn't have said that, but, yeah. that was what we were planning. And so, we still have all that stuff.
So on the far end of the spectrum, Jose was in the beginning. Jose left. He's back in. I've put 50 years into this. I'll be 50 this year. I never left.
Yeah, yeah.
I've seen the highs, the lows, the in-betweens. We've lost tracks throughout the years. It's how we invest in our time. Racing was a big part of it, but when you're spending the amount of money to maintain these cars, like to go
on
to
a grassroots level,
on a grassroots level, like even to try to keep up, these guys are making 1,000 horsepower easy.
Yeah, it's crazy.
But it's a $15,000 long block.
Yep.
$8,000 training, fuel. You have a pit crew of 4 or 5 to help you out.
The truck.
Turn the car over that weekend. You're spending thousands and thousands of dollars just for a weekend to run. Nowadays, 7 seconds. My wisdom throughout the years have changed my priorities. So to spend thousands of dollars to run 7 seconds, I've reallocated my time to buying an expensive car to enjoy every weekend. You know, a lot of people say they're car guys. You've had a car down for many years. I'm going to call out a lot of people. You're car guys. You sit back and reminisce about 10, 15 years ago. But we got more years in front of us.
Yeah.
I'm always planning to get the guys out on the weekends. There's a Cars and Coffee. People will always rag, oh, you guys are driving to go stand around. But it's being around the family of friends that we are together.
Yep.
We get to a place to talk about and look at the same stuff that we like. I'm always looking to the future. I got more years behind me than in front of me. So
times have changed.
Times have changed.
Times have changed. Like, you know, back and the younger generations are I just relate to social media, like attention span. Like, you can't have a good car show now these days because people we'll go into a car show and walk right out and be like, okay, that's it. Like, back in the day, we would hang out at Hot Import Nights from open to close.
Yeah.
We would be in there, and we wouldn't get bored. We would be hanging out. We would be talking.
Kind of more upset it ended.
Yeah, I know, man. Totally.
Like, dude,
yeah,
we've been exactly. here. We got here at 6 a.m. to set up. It's midnight. Yeah. Like, oh, we got to go home?
Yeah, exactly. Now it's like you go to a car show, your car meet, you'd be there for like 45 minutes. You're like, all right, let's go home. Like, you know, like, it's different now.
Let's roll out.
It's different.
It's a little different now, but like I said, getting together with your friends on a Sunday morning, getting your stuff done, you're out of there by 10, 11 o'clock. You can go be with your family. Our time's very valuable nowadays. So just seeing the guys when you're putting in the 40, 50 hours of work each week, just to be with the guys for 3-4 hours on a Sunday morning, to me, that's a reset. We're able to put all the hours in for work, but we need times for ourselves. So to get the guys together, it's very important for us to realize that there's more to life than living the past. We got to live the future.
Yeah.
So with that being said, Jose, you're overdue, or this is the right time to do a Alpha reunion.
Yes.
How many members at the peak of Alpha?
Man, when we were talking about planning the 30th anniversary, which is this year, I was making the list of the members, and I know I missed some people, but it's close to 30, I think.
30?
Yeah, close to 30, maybe.
And probably more than half of them I haven't seen in the past 20 years.
Yeah, likewise, same with me. So.
But now you also have to think those 30 guys have families.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So that would be very cool to hopefully we're able to set a date and...
Yeah, and
see who shows up,
and maybe get people motivated to start.
Yeah, that's my goal here.
I
see this going. Like, so we get some people out of the woodwork.
Jimmy's come out of the woodwork. So we haven't seen Jimmy in 15 years, and the last couple of years he's been showing up with.
And he raced
his Steve still.
Yeah, so that would be nice too. That'd be great seeing some of the guys. Like, start another project. Or
I'd love to see. He probably won't come out, but
dust off
Nate,
the other project.
Nate.
Yeah,
that'd
Romero,
be cool to see Nate come out.
Yeah, a lot of people.
Well, I'm on my own road for inspiring other people because I'm trying something new myself. I'm originally a drag racer at heart. Started drag racing when I was 16, and I recently started doing the road course. I started last year.
Eventually, get once the white car is done, I want to try it out, man.
But it's to the point, like when I first went, I went by myself. I went with Harry and Rob, media guys, and like, it made me reminisce. Like, man, I missed the days of going to the track with the Alpha guys and rolling deep.
Let me know 30, next time 40 you go. Cars I'll deep
with you know 40 people. Meanwhile, I'm here at this new place by myself. Like, oh, man.
So the HPDE stuff, high performance driving education stuff, those tracks, it's to me bringing us back to the old school roots of bracket racing. You're not racing anybody but yourself.
Yeah, that's how I felt. Like, I'm just there to have a good time. Yeah. Like as right now, I'm racing against my own personal lap time right now. And it brings me back to just the heydays of learning how to drag race, right? Yeah. And thankfully, at the last race I went to, there's a group of guys, Pinoy Racing, in the area, all Filipino guys. And thankfully, they took me in. I was having problems with my car, and one of the guys that I knew, they're all super friendly guys, like, yo, what's going on? Like, man, my car's broke. Or not even before it broke. I couldn't even get on the track because English Town wouldn't let me on the track for a safety reason. One of the guys let me drive their car.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Like, he's like, dude, you could just take my car. Like, I don't really know you like that. Like, we bumped into each other. And that's kind of like, it reminded me of the community and, you know, the team that we had, because that's what they've got going on. And, you know, they've taken me under their wing. And I just saw them last weekend and like, yo, we're going to let you know next time we go out so you could come with us. I'm like, word. Yeah, man. It's like,
nice.
Rolling with a team is a whole lot different than, you know, racing by yourself. And, you know, there's, goes both ways. Like, there's so many people that I know that go weekend racing and, you know, have a blast. But me coming from being part of a team.
To get accepted into another
team. Yeah.
It's way more funner racing as a racing with a team, especially when shit goes wrong. There's a lot of other heads to bounce off of and help you get back on track.
Yeah, that's the big plus of rolling with friends. I mean, even when we
borrow parts
back in the day, right? Someone will break down. It's like,
whatever
I just
you
remember,
need to get you back on the track.
I
take the axle off my car.
Right. Or my example, I did a burnout, and I ripped the drive shaft apart. And then your brother's like, get it towed to my shop. I'll put it back together. Like, to have that, you know, is
invaluable.
Very invaluable, and is very appreciative, like, to have that. If I didn't have these friends and I broke, I'd have to figure out myself.
Yeah. I remember that's how I learned how to change an axle. I blew an axle at Raceway Park using your slicks, maybe.
Yeah.
And came back in the pit, like, dude, what happened? I remember I just saw that thing dangling. Dave's like, let's swap it right now. I was like, we could do that right now. And Dave's like, yeah, just take, somebody broke here. Just take an axle from their car. I was like, dude, I don't know how to do that. Dave's like, I'll show you. Like, they're banging an axle. They're like, whoa, I just learned how to change an axle. It's actually not that hard in my EKB series.
Yeah, man. We had to learn to pitting for Arvin. I think we had to do it under 5 minutes to change an axle, because that was like the time gap between rounds. So like I had to learn that, like, change an axle in 5 minutes. So I was like, what?
And it was so common back then.
Yeah, back then. Yeah.
But yeah, that's when drive shaft was still trying to figure it out.
Yeah. Shaft shop, drive shaft shop.
Drive shaft shop.
Yeah.
With that being said, think we need this Alpha reunion sooner than later. Grab more guys, get them back involved in some way, whether you just at least come into a Cars and Coffee.
Yeah.
And then hopefully develop that itch to get you back on track. Get you in a money pit like my CRX, because the unfortunate side is once you start racing, you start dumping a whole lot of money.
Yeah,
that's true. But there's still lots of events going on. Hit me up, Money Making Dave. There's things to do every weekend. Come on out. There's things to do. We're gonna,
especially in New Jersey.
Yeah, there's memories to be made. And like, to me, making these memories are valuable. Doing the warehouse Sundays here now. You know, our families are involved. Our kids are involved.
And it's kind of crazy. Like, I'll even bring that up. Seeing the evolution of where we've come as a team of now the second generation Collie's kids who are. Colin's how old? 27?
No. 22. Alina's 29, I think.
Right, and they both have their own modified cars of their own, and they've got Alpha crazy banners on their cars. Like, I Colley put up a post one time, like, it makes him tear thinking about it, like how his love for cars passed down to his kids, and now his kids are repping Team Alpha. Like, yeah, dude, it's
and
freaking
Fast
awesome.
Fast Life, I said, you know, when are you ever going to get a chance to say father race son?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, exactly.
You know, that's that, so that epic, took many right? years, and that was cool to see.
Yeah, thankfully, and now I'm passing the love down to my son. We're actually going to a race tomorrow at Maple Grove. He's going to race his Power Wheel. And
nice.
when he asked me this morning, he was like, oh, where are you going? I was like, oh, I have work. And he was like, we're still racing tomorrow, right? I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
I was like, you ready? He's like, I want to go fast. I was like, oh, man.
Oh, yeah.
I've got it. I'm in for it.
Yeah.
I'm totally in for it. So, you know, it's awesome seeing a bunch of the guys pass down their love for racing and love for cars. Forgot who I was with yesterday that we're talking cars, and he's like, well, I was like, oh, you're going to get rid of it? He's like, no, I'm passing that down to my kid. I was like, dude, that's like 20-something years from now. Word, that's awesome. You know, it's like we all have that.
20-something years, it goes by really fast. So I built my EK 2001, and, you know, I always said it was going to be the car that my daughter learned how to drive stick. So she just got her license like a year ago, but she's still learning how to drive.
Don't trust her yet to
not yet. Every rim has told a story. So the generations are gonna come and go. It's our job as parents to make sure that they're better than us.
They have better cars than us.
Yes.
faster cars.
You know,
faster.
Growing up, we always we learned as our generation to make our parents proud. And we can't fail the next generation by letting them get away with this mentality that everyone gets a trophy.
Are you second? You're technically a second generation car enthusiast, right?
Yes, I would say.
I want to say me and my brother are first generation. Our dad tinkered with cars, but he wasn't into modifying them. So, you know, like, it's cool seeing the evolution. You're first generation
car
enthusiast.
Yep.
So, yeah, it's cool. You know, like, realizing that these hobbies do get passed down to the generation, because as we've met through the years, like, there are racing families that they've been doing it for generations, years yeah. long. Because we're first generation, it's eye-opening to us. Like,
It's our legacy. We're like, we got to leave our kids with something that we like. We're raising them in this environment that we enjoy, and they're starting to enjoy as well. You know, one important thing was my youngest daughter, Bella, she said, my favorite time of year was, Father's Day. That's when we get all the families. When all the car guys get all their families together, and it's one meet that she likes to go to.
That's the truth about it, though. And honestly, that's the reason why I love this so much. Because Dave, especially, Dave was a guy that I didn't know who he was. Dave lived in the same neighborhood as us.
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, all you. Yeah,
everyone. And Dave would drive by in his Eclipse or Civic back then.
It was Civic,
with a loud ass exhaust. But anytime he left his house, he had to drive by our house, and I would run to the window. Dave wouldn't know this. I would run to the window because I heard him like, "Oh, that's the car," and I would see him drive by. And then Fran started hanging out with you because you guys worked at Cedar Oaks together.
We worked together.
I was like, you're the guy with the car that I would always look at, because I watch you transition cars from the Civic to the Eclipse.
The Supra lived there.
Didn't you have a Prelude at one point?
My brother had a Prelude.
And then I would see all your friends come by in their cars, and that's honestly where my itch for cars started, even before my brother got into it, because I would see your cars coming by like, man, those are so cool. And then my brother started getting into cars, and I started reading the magazines. Dude, I was 10, 12 years. That was over 30 years that I technically knew you without knowing you.
Yeah. Same with Dave. Every time we'd see each other, like in college, it was like,
parking lot confrontation.
Yeah, like, oh, what's up?
And look at this, 30 years later,
and
you know, in our closest group of friends, if not family, because friends, you're a kid's goddaughter.
And he's my daughter's godfather, so like kinda we
crazy,
really became
right?
family
because of cars. We became family because of cars,
And, you know, that's another thing, too, that this brand has lasted this long is because it's more of the passion for it than the, yeah, we need to make money, but, you know, the passion is what keeps us going as a brand.
Yeah, that's a fact. Like, I worked a full-time job for the first 20 years, for the first 15 years of this business because the business wasn't making enough money. The business was just making enough money to reinvest, and I worked full-time jobs, but what kept me into it, and in some years we were down, kept me into it is we were still doing this no matter what, because these are our friends. This is what we do. Like, even if this brand didn't exist, I'm still hanging out with Dave, right? At the end of the day, we're car guys, so even if this brand doesn't exist, we're still into cars, and we're still hanging out on the weekends doing what we do, and it's to the point where it's not even about the cars anymore because it's just a random non-car thing and we're still hanging out because, like we said, friends became family.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, you know, even with Jose, right? He's been out of it, but, you know.
Like never left.
Came back like he never left.
No, he never left. Yeah, I mean, we go. I don't go to the Philippines a lot, but whenever we do go to, that's like, let's meet up with Jose.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, it's not, it's cars, but we became friends. We became good friends, right? So, you know.
Even with Ed, I haven't seen Ed in over 15 years. Ed looks at my car and he's already fixing it.
Yeah. Or one of the first things you told him, like, yo, you need to use the lift. Come over to the shop.
Yo.
You're offering the lift to him. Dave's like, yo, call me if you need help. Like, I'll help you guys. Like, immediately. Get the cars back in.
Last week, and Ed's like, popped the hood. Like, oh, dude, we got to fix this, and this. I was like, came back like you never left.
Yeah, man. I'm like a time capsule coming back into this. It's like, whoa, all this stuff is like, crazy.
Still here. It's still, and it's not going anywhere.
Yeah. Never.
That's the beauty about, you know, the car culture as a whole. I see it outside of our group, you know, with a whole lot of other friends as well. Like, same thing. It's the cars that brought people together and started families. You know, people met other people through cars, and now they're passing it on to the next generation. It's amazing. Yeah. With that being said.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you guys for coming. You know,
thank you for having us.
We're definitely gonna have. We should definitely have a little bit. I don't think we covered everything, but we should definitely get another one. Probably get
more
of the guys coming on, and we could get a little roundtable of all the stories that we had. Right. Yeah. So thank you guys for jumping on.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah. All right.
And if you want to follow you on social media,
SS_agent. That's what I'm just low key, but yeah. On Instagram?
Money Making Dave. I'm private. I don't show my life to everybody.
At Brian ESR, at Frankie5 ESR, of course, at Eat Sleep Raise, and at Eat Sleep Raise Podcast. Stay tuned for the next episode.
Peace.